from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, following the success of their book, Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, the two editors got a flood of responses from American Muslim men wanting to share their side of the story. In the new book, Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy, 22 American Muslim men share their experiences. And the contributors come from diverse backgrounds, and the stories range from comic to tragic. The editor and contributors to Salam Love will join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this Forum hour, we take up the topic of American Muslim men and their experiences with love, sex, and intimacy. Salam Love, which is a book made up of 22 American Muslim men's stories by the editors of another book that appeared before this book called Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. And one of the editors is here with us in studio. I want to introduce her to you. Aisha Matu is a co-editor. Mentioned the book again, Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Stephen Leeper here in studio, who is a contributor and tells his story in the book. Welcome, Stephen Leeper.
Thank you.
And also with us by phone this morning is Rami El Trebe. He's a contributor as well in the book. He's with us from El Trebe, excuse me. He's with us from Los Angeles. Rami El Trebe, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Sam Pierstorf, who is with us from Modesto this morning, another contributor to this collection. Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you all, and I thought I'd begin with Aisha. Aisha Matu is here with us in studio, and as I said, there was a book that came out earlier called Love Inshallah about Muslim women, American Muslim women, the secret love lives of them. And there was a public reaction to this that was very strong. And I think it's very positive. That is a public perception of Muslims being perhaps not those stereotypes that many Americans have in their minds. And I think this book serves that same purpose. But you kind of got stalked after this first book. A lot of men said, why don't you do this about us, right?
Absolutely. My co-editor, Noura Masnavi, and I joke about the fact that after the first book came out, we began to be stalked by Muslim men at dinner parties, over email, sort of just all of them asking, where are our stories? And we would laugh and respond, please. Men don't talk about their feelings. That would be the shortest book ever. But we kept getting these questions, and we decided to ask ourselves, is it the fact that men don't talk about their feelings, or is it that they don't have the space to speak about their feelings?
Well, that may be a stereotype about men, or about Muslim men in particular. And you're going up against, with this book, a lot of stereotypes. I mean, you've talked about the diversity and range, and there is certainly a lot of that here. I want to talk about that a bit with you. But also the fact that people have in their minds, I don't know, some oversexed Muslim who wants to die for 72 virgins, or some big bearded husband who said they're ready to go on a rampage over a hint of dishonor. I mean, you're battling against stereotypes, really, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I think that both of these books come from a very personal space of wanting to smash the Muslim monolith and really give a snapshot of how incredibly diverse and rich our community really is in terms of ethnicity, race, religious perspectives. This is one of the few spaces that we have Orthodox, cultural, and secular Muslims speaking with each other and listening to each other's stories, bearing witness to each other's lives. And yes, there absolutely are stereotypes. Muslim women are seen as silent and oppressed. Muslim men are seen as oppressors and frightening.
And often misogynist.
Yeah. And yet none of these stereotypes are reflective of the men and women that we know in our own lives. I have a Muslim father, a Muslim husband, I'm raising a Muslim son. In no way do they conform to those stereotypes. And we really wanted to open up the space for them to tell us what's important in their lives. And I think that that's exactly what they do in this collection.
We're going to talk to some of the men who are featured in this book, but before we do that, I just wondered about, I mean, there is a lot of diversity here, but not too many conservatives. I mean, most of these men who talk are men who are more progressive in their politics, and probably I don't think any of them are blue-collar, so I'm wondering, again, about that kind of a span. For example, I think about Muslim men, I think about different cultures. I mean, Arab men as opposed to Indian men as opposed to Muslim men in Africa. So the range is pretty broad to just begin with. And what about more conservative Muslims?
Well, I believe in both of the books, in both of the collections, we actually do have Orthodox voices.
Politically conservative.
Well, politically conservative, we ask them to share their love stories. And so what comes across in the love stories in some cases are there are stories of people growing up in working class backgrounds. There are stories of being raised in fairly Orthodox families and how that affects people and their search for love, the family values that they hold, the cultural, religious, sometimes political values that they hold, displayed through specifically the lens of love.
Well, let's talk to some of the men again who are featured. Stephen Leeper is here with us in studio. He's one of the contributors, and he's an African-American who lives here in San Francisco. His father was part of the Nation of Islam, and your mother was a Pentecostal, but you were raised in the Muslim faith.
I was actually raised Pentecostal.
Oh, okay. So you became a Muslim why?
Well,
or when?
I became a Muslim when I was in college. I went to Winston-Salem State University, and I was raised by my mother, and I didn't really have a relationship with my father when I was younger. And when I moved, when I went off to college, I was closer to him in terms of proximity, and I started to build a relationship with him. And I was curious about his faith because I was Christian and I didn't understand much about Islam, and I used to try to get in debates with him to prove what I believed or what he believed, and ended up reading the Quran and being really moved by its words, and it's what led me on this path.
And you were what age when you...
I was a freshman in college, so...
And became a Muslim and actually met a woman at a Muslim community meeting. I mean, that's where romance started for you, yes?
Yes. My wife had just moved back from Baltimore State. She actually just moved back from Baltimore. She went to Morgan State, and she hadn't been back that long before I met her, and I was a community organizer at the time, and I was facilitating a meeting, and that's when I first met her.
You say you're a community organizer, people immediately say Obama, right?
Yeah, actually, that's the first association that people have in their minds, and at the San Francisco Muslim Community Center, they've been pushing me to run for political office, but I don't think I'm interested in that.
But you both came, you and your wife, from failed relationships, we should mention, yes?
Yes, that's true. My wife had been married before. I had never been married, but I was in a relationship that ended right when I moved here in 2009, and it didn't end so well, and I was heartbroken, and it led to some very destructive, self-destructive behavior for me for a couple years.
So when you think of love and being Muslim, or when you think of intimacy or sex and being Muslim, what are your associations? How does that perhaps define you, or how does that part of your identity?
Well, I think that being Muslim and being in love is not too different from other people's experience of being in love. I mean, I think that there's this idea that we're more different than we are alike. And I think that we experience heartbreak in some of the same ways that other people do, and joy and confusion and fear when it comes to being in relationships. I think that our identity as Muslim, it does color our experience of love, but not in a way that alienates us or makes us extremely different from
so just like the rest of the human species. I mean, you can suffer heartbreak, you can fall in love deeply, and all the rest of it. Yeah,
that's right.
I mean, it's, I think, an important point that comes through in this book. And Sam Pierstorf is also with us. Sam Pierstorf is a contributor to the book Salam, Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. He's in Modesto, and he is the product of a Syrian mother and a Kentucky father, described as a redneck. That's a word we've kind of retired from use here. But your wife is an Indian American, and you didn't grow up talking about this with other Muslims. I mean, these kinds of subjects were a bit taboo, weren't they, Sam?
Yeah. No, there's definitely a desire to kind of maintain a reputation of perfection among the community, and I think that stigma attached to, you know, being girl crazy, even being attracted to the other sex is sort of a taboo. So, yeah, we definitely weren't open. We were very good at keeping our secrets and hiding and being very discreet about whatever relationships we may have been in.
But you were in relationships. I mean, you write about your own puppy love and teen lust and those kinds of things. I mean, natural kind of boyhood, adolescent, growing up and maturing.
Right. You know, I think as I contemplate my own children now, I think when you put so much pressure on young children to not be in love, to not seek girlfriends, to not go on dates, once you do, you just explode and you go a little nuts. So, yeah, I think my mom, although her intentions were good, by really treating girls as if they were some great sin, she made them much more enticing, more interesting for me.
Yeah, Isha, I mean, there are a number of stories in here where the mothers are really the problem. I mean, the Muslim mothers don't like these American girls or they reject them. I mean, we can talk some more with Sam and also with our other guest, Rami, but seemed to be a little bit of a pattern.
Well, I think that mothers are often in the primary caregiving role, and so they do have to take on discipline. And some of the mothers are dealing with some of them are immigrants. Some of them are, like Stephen's family, born and raised here for many generations. But in some cases, they are dealing with cultural shifts. And I think that's a normal part of the immigrant narrative of what values do they bring from abroad and which ones do they pass on to their children. And sometimes the American culture can be seen as somewhat frightening in its permissiveness towards sexuality. But I hope that these books will actually be read by every religious leader and parent, Muslim parent or otherwise, in this nation, because I think that it really opens up this idea of open communication between the parent and child is absolutely integral to a healthy sexuality, intimacy building and relationship building later on.
Now, you feature a gentleman who had a Pakistani gentleman, Pakistani American, whose mother attempted suicide rather than, I mean, it had a happy ending, but, you know, she wound up calling the woman my daughter. But early on, there was a lot of trouble. And then there was a Libyan American here in San Francisco whose mother was so overprotected, she refused to accept his relationship. So you do, in fact, Sam, let me go back to you, Sam Pierstorf. There were cultural differences, though, that really ought to be highlighted here. I mean, you did keep your chastity, and you presumably will expect that from your kids?
I will encourage that, certainly, but I'm also well aware of our culture and how it works. And, you know, I imagine we will have the safe sex talk in a few more years. But still, the underlying, you know, premise of so much is purity and chastity and self-respect. And, you know, I want him to not be afraid of women. I want him to learn to respect women and understand, you know, where they come from. And so I won't create a giant fear as if women are only about sex and sexuality. I mean, there's a whole lot else going on there that I really wasn't aware of.
What about all that peer influence, though? I mean, your kids are going to have it. You probably had it. You know, the cultural differences. You're expected to act often, young boys, like they're driven by their hormones and their testosterone, particularly.
Right. And that's part of our culture, our American culture. You know, if, you know, less so, I think, than, you know, in Islamic, you know, culture, we're driven, our masculinity is defined largely by, you know, man's sex drive and sexuality, and women are objectified. And so, you know, we'll have those conversations really outside of a religious, you know, basis. And, you know, I have a daughter, too, so he's got to learn how to really understand and respect women and not treat them as the other. I didn't grow up with a sister, so women really were just these dangerous creatures who could, you know, kiss you and give you diseases.
Well, I also want to mention that Sam Pierstorf has gone on record saying he'd like to have a beer to make ZZ Top jealous without being called a fundamentalist. And let me actually bring in Rami. Eletubre, and he's a contributor to the book again, Solemn Love, American Muslim Men, Salam Love, American Muslim Men, Love, Sex, and Intimacy. I mean, you had kind of, a double thing going for you, Rami. You wanted to be you were a master of suppression. You were Muslim and you were gay.
Yeah, definitely. Though I relate as to all that teen angst of trying to keep your sexual desires under wraps whether I was attracted to women or boys, it was all the same thing. My parents would always encourage me to keep to myself.
Well, and then you met a guy named Corey, kind of a druggy guy, yeah?
Sure. I mean, yeah, that's not a title I like to place upon him, but, this was someone who was constantly, thrill-seeking, and his choice in doing so was through experimenting with, different pharmaceuticals and alcohol and guns and, anything that, would get the heart rate racing he was into.
But you're also the son of the chair of a California mosque, as I understand it. I mean, there must have been some really extraordinary throes of agony that you went through about guilt and about your family's reaction to being homosexual.
Definitely, like guilt, and there's a great amount of shame attached to recognizing that you're homosexual. So there's a couple years there from your own coming out to yourself before you start telling the important people in your life. I mean, for me, I think I was self-closeted for maybe, 9 years before I told my family anything.
Well, there's also a deep aversion to homosexuality among, not only religious Muslims, among religious Jews, religious Christians. I mean, you had to contend with that, too.
Yeah, it basically was my own private, secret life. The only people who knew how I felt was my close friends in high school. And we were all drama kids, we're all theater kids. So that's where the gay high schoolers would go to, find sanctuary.
Well, this experience you went through with this young man, Corey, it changed your whole relationship with, Allah, didn't it?
Yeah, I would say it changed my whole relationship with myself, truly. I would say before Corey, I definitely was too afraid to explore the sides of me that that I had kept suppressing. You can't suppress anything forever, and it will explode, as Sam talks about in his story. And so you have to, when I met Corey, he really encouraged me to explore the parts of my identity that I've been too afraid to explore. And it was sort of my relationship with him that had me really, come out to myself in a much larger way, almost like politically, to recognize that being gay is not something I really should suppress, and to, start associating with other gay people in public places, in public spaces, to start to reduce the stigma of shame and secrecy that I was holding on to.
Rami Eletubre, again, is with us from Los Angeles this morning, one of the contributors to Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. And let me invite listeners to join this conversation. In fact, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. You may have your own stories to tell, those of you in the Muslim communities. But you may also want to ask questions. And if you want to join us, you can do it now at 866-733-6786. Our toll-free number again, and we do welcome your calls, is 866-733-6786. You can direct your questions to any of our men who are here with us, contributors to the book, or to Isha Matu, who's also with us, co-editor of Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. We also welcome your communications by email, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Isha, can I get you a little to talk about, just in a general way, about relationship again with God? I mean, there were some who broke away from God, who felt or Allah was not working in their on their behalf or was not serving them, and they therefore perhaps didn't need to serve Allah. But there were those who forged even stronger relationships, stronger faith, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that both of the books and Salaam Love in particular really cover this idea of faith as an ongoing question and struggle and intention that we begin each day with. So the idea that it's not static, it's something that unfolds over our lives, and there are times of closeness and times of distance. There are times of feeling quite lost sometimes and then being brought home again, as Rami so beautifully talks about in his own story. And I think that there's a beautiful reality and openness to these stories. Often faith has been presented to us when we were children as something that we must have a blind belief in, and that is completely static and constant in our lives. And so when we do feel that doubt or questioning or distance, it can feel like a complete breakdown of faith rather than a natural part of faith unfolding. And so I think that these stories really show the journey of life, of transformation, the messiness and complexity that comes from that, from those journeys, the beauty and joy and pain and loss. And I think that it enables young American Muslims to embrace that messiness of their lives and say, it's okay. And it's okay to explore that through storytelling, through sharing with others in the community. And I think it only makes us stronger as individuals and as a community.
There are some real cultural differences, though, that come through here. I'm thinking particularly of one story of a Malaysian American from Brooklyn who was trying to convince a woman to be his second wife. I mean, you get into those kinds of differences. There's also a story which was kind of amusing in some ways, but it was an Iraqi American who learned Farsi rather than explain that he's an Arab ethnically to a young woman who he had fallen for, who happened to be of Iranian descent. So you've got a whole broad, wide swath of stories here. And that brings up the whole realization that when we speak about American Muslims, we're speaking about heterogeneity, about such a strong continuum in terms of cultural differences and religious differences. And I keep making that point simply because I think there are too many people who see things differently. They, I think, as you pointed out, they think about the Maldives president blocking a law prohibiting marital rape, or of the Saudi Arabians not allowing women to drive or be in public without a male relative accompanying them. And this is their notion of what somehow is tied to the Muslim faith. I'd like to hear from our listeners, though. And again, we invite you to participate in this. Following the success of Love Insha'Allah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women, two editors, Isha Matu and Noura Masnavi, got a flood of responses from American Muslim men who wanted to share their side of the story. And in the book, Salaam Love, 22 Muslim American Men Do That. And we're talking about stories of sex, love, and intimacy. If you have a story you'd like to share, if you're a member of the American Muslim community, or if you have a question for our guests, feel free to join us. Again, this is a representational number of stories from different backgrounds, and they range from comic to tragic. We can hear your stories as well. Toll-free number 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website kqed.org/forum. Our guests include Isha Matu, co-editor of the book, and the three contributors who are with us here in studio, Stephen Leeper, by phone from Modesto, Sam Pierstorf, and by phone from Los Angeles, Rami Elatrube. And we'll go to your calls and your emails when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about American Muslim men speaking out on love, sex, and intimacy, which they do in a new book called Salaam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy, which is co-edited by Isha Matu, who's here with us in studio, and her co-editor, Noura Masnavi. And with us are three of the contributors to that book as well. In studio, Stephen Leeper, and with us by phone, Rami Elatrebe and Sam Pierstorf. And we'll go to your calls here. Let me, in fact, begin going back to Aisha, to ask her to mention a few events that are of note and that she wants you to know about. Aisha?
Yes, I'll be joining four other women artists for a celebration of International Women's Day this Friday, March 7th at La Peña Cultural Center, where we will be talking about sex. On the 21st, we'll be at ICCNC in Oakland for a book reading and signing, and at Yale University on March 27th.
When you say we'll be women talking about sex, is there a general kind of discomfort, especially for those maybe brought up in a more pious kind of Muslim household with a subject like sex? Because it is often taboo in those households.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I actually look at Islam as a very sex-positive religion, traditionally at least within a marital and hetero sort of a relationship-oriented. But, you know, I think that there are some really interesting conversations happening around that. And when we look at the Prophet's relationships with his wives and the openness that he and his community had around speaking about sex and sexual issues, they were probably a lot more open than we are as a community now. And I hope that these books help bring some of that openness back into seeing sexuality as a normal, healthy part of our lives, and that parents and religious leaders should be taking on a role of both listening and helping to have more open conversations with their children.
Rami, I'm curious to get your response when you hear that most traditional Muslims talk about sex in the sex positive, but in the context of, I think, as Aisha put it, a heterosexual marriage.
Yeah, I mean, not just Muslims. I think that's just most people put everything in a heterosexual context.
Mm-hmm.
But does it make you feel less allied to your faith or to your people when you hear something like that or when you reckon with that?
Not anymore. It did do that for me in the past. I think I was very quick to see myself always on the outside of the dominant narrative. And while that's not necessarily different today in terms of not being part of the dominant narrative, I no longer use the subject matter as a way to, like, you know, for me to, like, get angry, as for me to, like, feel like, oh, why is my story not being spoken about, or why people are not recognizing that there are non-heteronormative experiences out there. I sort of have now come to a realization that it is, you know, up to me to put those stories out there and not, you know, chide other people for not recognizing it. It's because maybe we're not telling enough of our own stories.
Sam Pierstorf, I'm just curious to know, say your daughter, when she's 16, comes to you and says, I'd like to go on birth control.
Uh-huh. That's not going to happen.
You can say with absoluteness,
I can't. I'm kidding. That would be a conversation I hope we preempt. I hope we can get to her before she comes to us and we say, look, here are your options. And, you know, number one, in an Islamic household, you know, chastity, purity, respecting your body, not giving anything away is primary. However, I also know that you're young and you're an American girl. And, you know, here are the ways in which we hope you'll protect yourself if you go that route. But a very, very strong emphasis will be on not going that direction. But I'm not a fool, and I'm not going to pretend that might not happen. But I will ask her to be very, very careful. So we'll have that conversation hopefully before she asks.
And Stephen Lieber, let me ask you, how does your faith work now in your marriage? And to what degree does it work as part of your marriage?
I think that, you know, my faith has really changed my relationship with other women. I grew up being raised by mostly women. So I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and my mother and my aunties and my female cousins. And throughout school and throughout life, I've had a lot of friends who were women. And that has to shift now that I'm married. And I have to include my wife in those relationships that I have with other women. And I have to just be mindful of how my relationship with other women, whether it be professional or just colleagues or friends, might impact her.
But how does that work in terms of the faith? Does it work? I mean, I got to hear somebody from any religion say the same thing. I was raised with women, and now I've got to be concerned about my relationship with my wife. I'm asking you about your faith and
sure,
the way it plays
sure.
in your marriage. Yeah.
Well, there is, what comes to mind is a hadith of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that when a man and a woman are alone, the devil makes a third. And I think that I have to be on guard in terms of, you know, being in spaces with women, because my religion, I believe, my interpretation of Islam, there is not too loose the intermingling of the sexes.
So you got to be aware of temptation. With
right,
women,
exactly. And that's a big part of the religion is really being on guard and protecting yourself and just being mindful and trying to be responsible in every aspect of your life, including the relationships that you have, and being very intentional with the kinds of relationships you have with men and women, I think is a big part of Islam.
So a woman, for example, you might meet at work, or a woman you might could become acquainted with says, Stephen, I really like you, I want to be friends, and you find her attractive, what happens?
Well, I really am clear about the type of relationship that I'm going to be having with this woman, and then including my wife in that relationship. I think that's important. And so when I'm meeting with this young woman who's attractive, that I have my wife with me.
Okay. And I really love what you said in The Secret Desires of Muslim Men about wanting to be led by your wife in spirituality as well as in love, if you wanted to speak a little bit to that, because I think that's very much a part of faith and how it plays out in your marriage.
Absolutely. Thank you for that question. You know, my wife has, she's taught me surahs of the Quran. And the reason I married my wife is because she reminded me of Allah. She reminded me of my Lord and of my commitment to my faith and helped renew that commitment. And that's what drew me to her.
And thank you, Aisha. I was sort of getting at that in a roundabout way, but you put it very directly. Let me get to our callers in not so roundabout way. Eunice is our first caller. Good morning.
Yeah, this is definitely a very familiar subject to me. I studied the life of gay Muslims in the United States for the last 10 years. And I discovered something very interesting. There are three categories of gay men of Muslim descent who deal with their sexual and their religious identity in a very specific way. So there is the category of men who completely reject their sexuality and pursue a very religious, strict identity. And then there is a group of gay Muslims who pursue their sexual identity and reject completely their faith. And the recent discourse of Islamophobia, especially after 9/11, have made a great impact on their ability to completely reject their Muslim faith. And then there is a group, what I would say about 50% out of the 700 gay men I studied in the last 10 years, who have found a way to reconcile their sexual and their religious identity in a very spiritual and beautiful way, where these two different identities coexist together without greater suffering. And I have found this to be a very interesting trend among gay Muslims. And the other thing I want to add is that there are gay Muslims in the United States who are able to experience their sexuality, to be good Muslims, and have a way of reconciling these two identities.
Well, Eunice, thank you for that data. I appreciate your calling in with it. And I'm wondering where romance fits in all of this. I'm going to go to you again on this, Aisha. I mean, whether it's gay Muslims or heterosexual Muslims or, you know, whatever the preference is, what about the role of romance in Muslim life?
I think the stories so clearly illustrate a great commitment and desire for romance, whether it's wooing someone during the courtship or it's trying to get that first kiss or sneaking out to prom or, you know, talking about your first girlfriend or how you met your wife and fell in love with her and decided that she was the person you wanted to spend your life with. So I think romance absolutely plays a role in many, many of these stories and is something that's very important to many of these men. However, I would say that Stephen had spoken about how there are, and I agree that there's more similarities that draw us together than there are differences that set us apart. However, some of the differences that I think are important in these stories are the men's commitment to faith, family, and marriage. And I remember talking to one of my women friends who's not Muslim after she read the book, and she said, who are these guys? I never meet these guys who want to be in a committed relationship, and yet in this story after story after story, men who want to get married. And she was
you
really
struck by
that.
You should set up a dating service, right? I think, maybe on the side here.
But it's a real commitment to finding the person you want to spend your life with, and I think that's incredibly romantic.
And here's another caller from Oakland. Mahafin, good morning.
Yes, it's Mahafin, and thank you, Michael. Good morning, and happy to be here. I have a question, and I guess it's sort of a part of the conversation you all were having with Stephen, because Stephen is a person that I know, and we've worked together in the Muslim community, and at the time I met him, he was very actively involved in organizing the political structure in the community and teaching citizen participation. That's the work that I had done in Oakland, so naturally it brought us together.
And you're one of the women he can work with without his wife.
Well, that's right, because I'm the grandmotherly type. In fact, I have a son who's just a little bit older than Stephen, so I always had that perspective of him. And he's a very personable Muslim young man, and so it made it very easy to have familial feelings toward him. Part of organizing is building relationships, so I know there is a lot of pressure for getting to the core of who people really are when you're developing political relationships and ability to trust and work together. So I was so impressed with him because of just what seemed to be his personality and nature, an intense interest in the human being. And so that's where we were. The question I was going to ask him was, as he was going through his journey approaching marriage and approaching meeting his present mate, who is a lovely young lady, what was it? What was the core and essence of that that brought him to the conclusion that she would complete him? Or what role does the completion on all of the people you're interviewing today, what role does that play in your relationship and decision? I hope that's clear.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Mahafin. Stephen, you want to go first here?
Sure. I think that, you know, when I met my wife, I was in a lot of pain, and I was still grieving the loss of the love that I had before. And what my wife helped me to realize is that I had a void in me that I was trying to fill with a romantic relationship with a woman that should have been filled with the love of God and my commitment to my faith. And I'm reminded of what my sheikh says, who's a religious teacher, that in the heart there are sort of like boxes, and you need to make sure that in those boxes are the right people and the right thing. So there is a space in your heart for a romantic relationship with the woman that God created, and then there's a space for that only can be filled with the love of Allah. And that's what my wife helped me to realize, and that's where the completion I felt came into place.
And let me actually, since she asked the question about completion, go to you on this, Sam Persdorf. What are your thoughts?
I think marriage is a huge part of Muslim life, and it completes our faith, as we say. It's half of faith. So, you know, I've always considered myself an old soul. I was very, very young when I got married. I mean, by today's standards, I met my wife. I was about 23, and within a couple months, I was proposing. and that may not be abnormal in the Muslim community, but it's fairly abnormal in a secular American world. So, you know, I met a girl and she was Muslim and she's pretty. I was ready to go. It was done. She was not so quick to respond in the affirmative, so it took a little bit more courting.
Would it be oxymoronic to speak of Muslim players?
No.
I mean, particularly those who cleave to their faith in a strong way. I mean, what all of you are saying is you're completed when you when you find another person that's very much tied in with the faith, although there are secular and non-religious Muslims that tell their stories in this book. What about you, Rami? Can I get to you on this?
Well, you know, I'm single, so I guess I'm incomplete by those standards. I would say that for me, in my search for a mate, which is unending, it seems that...
Until there's a happy ending, right?
Hopefully it's a happy ending one day. I have faith. I believe that what is being touched upon by Stephen and Sam is the fact that, you know, the source of completion is actually not the other person. It's your faith in God. And as you continue to work on that relationship, you know, then God may provide you with, you know, another person to, you know, move even closer to God with. And I would say on my journey, you know, I'm still working on my relationship with God. And so there probably is very little room for another person in that mix at the moment.
All right. I'm going to go to some emails here before I go to more calls. Sorur, a listener, writes, "Hi, growing up in the Mideast, I observed sexual suppression of young men that I believe affects character of grown men. The hypocrisy is breathtaking. It was really hard for women to walk in crowded public places without getting groped. We all saw what happened in Tahrir Square in Cairo. I even have a far-fetched theory that this suppression might have something to do with why young men who choose to become terrorists do so." And then another listener, Robert, says, "What do you guys think of Muslim men with several wives? Of course, this is not common in the USA, but not uncommon in the Middle East. And I would guess there might be a great gulf between attitudes of Muslim men in the Middle East and those in the United States." I mean, what both these emailers touch on is the difference between Muslim American men and men abroad. Yes, Aisha?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, the books are about American Muslims, and that's our cultural and religious community. And because we are talking about not that Muslims are not a monolith, it always strikes me as very strange when we get examples from abroad as if they necessarily have a bearing on my life here as an American. And what I would encourage all of us as Americans to do is, if we have concerns about the ways in which people are being treated abroad, that we speak to our elected representatives about that, about foreign aid and military aid being contingent upon the protection of women, children, and minorities in other countries across the board, not just in Muslim countries.
Well, here's Matt who writes, and I want to get your response to this. It sort of dovetails with what we're talking about. He says, "My experience is that Islam is a sex-positive religion." He's quoting you, Aisha. "How then does she explain that many Muslim societies spanning various cultures have very sexually repressive practices, such as shaming women who dare to not conform to repressive practices, like wearing clothes that don't conform to establishment ideas of how women should dress, or who are in public with a man other than family members, stoning women accused of adultery, killing women who were raped because her being raped dishonored the family, not letting a couple who cannot prove they are married stay in the same hotel room, etc., etc., etc.? I find your guest is like so many American Muslims. They say Islam is this, Islam is that, Islam isn't really about such and such, and they make statements that simply don't stand up to scrutiny. If Islam is a sex-positive religion, why is there so much sexual repression in all Muslim countries? Please address that."
I think it comes back to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's talk about the danger of the single narrative. And we have been fed the same story again and again and again until it has become the only reality that people respond to when it comes to Muslims. And when we try to tell any other story about Muslims, it's immediately shot down then as being false or untrue or could not possibly be true. And yet the reality of the situation is that there are always multiple narratives at play.
And again, Aisha
whether
Matu,
it's in Iran, Saudi Arabia, America, or anywhere else.
Aisha Matu is co-editor of Salam Love, American Muslim Women, on love, sex, and intimacy. A tweet from a listener who spells his or her name S-I-A-H. "How come there's no discussion about agnostic and atheist Muslims? We exist too."
And secular Muslims are a part of both of these books.
Another listener says, "I find to my surprise I was raised Muslim. I wonder how many other faiths teach that sex is something shameful you save for your eventual spouse." And Carol writes, "I've heard that there is an expression in the Muslim world, women are for children, men are for love. Is there any credibility to this assertion that it isn't uncommon for Muslim men to be on the down low?" maybe Rami, that should go to you. Because the download is often associated with men who have secret homosexual lives.
Is it uncommon? I would say no. I mean, I would say I would say it's almost expected, I think, as with any, if a Muslim man is being raised in a tight-knit Muslim community, as they go through their teenage years and recognize, you know, their own sex, there's going to be a period of, yeah, playing it on the down low, keeping it under wraps, you know, as that person, you know, makes their own work. You know,
well, it could be true about heterosexuals, Muslim men as well. I mean, if they're living in a fairly, I mean, this is true for religious orthodoxy of any variety, I think, that when sexuality is repressed, often it leads, especially during the adolescent years, to what is called the download. But let me bring some more of our callers on. Dawn, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. First of all, I love you, Michael. I wake up every morning with you, so thank you. And a quick comment and then a question. I was raised in a secular home. We celebrated holidays more as familial holidays, but my mom said when we were babies, some man asked her what religion she was going to raise us in, and she said, no religion. He said, how will you teach them morality? And the ironic thing is that a lot of people consider my sister and I almost prudish. But anyway, here's my question. Since I was raised in a secular home, I think that I really don't care what religion someone is when I'm dating. But I do notice that when the person, you know, whether it's when I meet them or on a site or whatever, when they say that they're religious, whatever the religion is, and they say that's important in their life, I tend to shy away. I guess you could say that I'm following my religion, which is agnosticism. But I wonder, for your guests, if their partner being Muslim is important or not important or whatever. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. And Sam Pierce-Surf, let's go to you first.
That's a great question. I know that when I was dating for a long time, I always had a tremendous fear. It was just kind of a ticking clock. I knew this relationship would end by virtue of her not being Muslim. It just would not go as far as I would want it to go. And then it wasn't until I met a girl who was, in fact, Muslim that I knew, okay, this is it. This is going to be easy. So it just simplified things so much. You know, I knew, you know, what we needed to do, how we needed to pray. We had, you know, so much in common that all we had to work out then was our personalities and making sure those aligned. And that was much easier. And there wasn't a lot of fear or anxiety about introducing her to my family and stuff. So it was very important to me. It really simplified the process. You know, moving forward with my own kids now, you know, my wife and I debate this all the time. You know, are we going to care if, you know, our son brings home a, you know, Christian woman or agnostic or whatever? And, I don't know. I don't know. I think I would like him to maintain his cultural and religious identity. But I also, at the core, as long as that person's good and her heart is good, then I think we'll be pretty open.
Okay. Did you want to comment on this, Stephen? Stephen Leeper?
Sure, briefly. It is important to me. I did date a lot of Christian women when I was younger, both before I converted to Islam and after. But I think that my wife being Muslim and being African-American is important to me. We share a similar cultural background. I have family history with the Nation of Islam. She has family history with the Nation of Islam. And so we have similar cultural sensibilities, and I think that's really important to both of us.
And looking at a Facebook comment from a listener named Shireen, who says, this is a general question, but I wonder if your speakers, as writers who are describing their experiences as Muslims to an American audience, have an opinion about using the word Allah instead of God when writing or speaking in English. I have always been taught that Jews, Christians, and Muslims agree that they believe in the same God, and I think using different names for that God creates a sense of us and them, especially in American culture. I'm curious to know what your speakers think about that.
We actually, as editors, were led by what our writers wanted to call God. It's a very personal decision, and we did not want to impose either God or Allah or any other word upon them. So different writers actually term the deity differently. And Noura and I also think it's important for people to know that we actually began both of these books in the name of Al-Wadud, who is the most loving and kind God. And we really meant them to be mirrors to show the diversity and divergence and beauty of the American Muslim community. And really, they are love letters to our community to everyone, the secular, the Orthodox, the cultural, the LGBTQ community, the African-American, the Arab, the South Asian communities. It's such a glorious community, and I really invite readers of all backgrounds to read these books, read these stories, and see yourself reflected in that most unexpected place, the heart of a Muslim.
Again, Aisha Matu is co-editor of Salam, Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. Quick question for you, Aisha, from Bill. If there are multiple Islamic narratives, does that include multiple narratives regarding premarital chastity, i.e., are there narratives in Islam such as that premarital sex under certain circumstances is acceptable for Muslims?
And that's really interesting. And as a religious, I'm not a religious scholar, so I'm not sure about that.
I'm not a religious scholar either, but I've done a lot of studying of religion, and I don't know that there are any narratives that suggest that losing chastity or indulging in premarital sex is necessarily good. I mean, particularly if you're going by the orthodoxy of any religion.
I mean, there are some really interesting narratives coming out with Orthodox and progressive religious scholars, and I think it would be an interesting conversation to have.
You want to mention again your event that's coming up?
Yes, on March 7th at La Peña Cultural Center for International Women's Day, 7 p.m., Women Talking About Sex.
Aisha Matu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, Aisha Matu is co-editor, along with Noura Masnavi, of Salam Love, American Muslim Men on Love, Sex, and Intimacy. Thanks to you, Stephen Leeper. Good to have you with us this morning.
Great to be here.
Thanks to Sam Pierstorf, who's with us from Modesto.
Thanks, Michael.
And thanks to Rami Elatrube, who is with us this morning from Los Angeles.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We can always, by the way, continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum, and always let us know what you think about what you hear on forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our Facebook page. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.